The current spoiler warning level is
meat.
Friends and folks, for this episode, you're looking at a spoiler warning level of meat. If you have been avoiding spoilers about space exploration in the meat realm in which you reside, this episode is going to spoil that for you. Otherwise, if you're just like, I live in the world and sometimes I read the news, you're good. Please enjoy the episode. Also, you don't have to read the news. It's just talking about real things. That's the point. It's not going to spoil a story. Hello, friends and folks, and welcome back to Mechanista NG, where everything solar panel can be found. I'm Zig Stepmar from Scanline Media.
And I'm Nick Cease, and this is a very spooky episode.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess this is the closest we'll have to a Halloween episode, huh?
I guess so. I mean, you can live your life, you know.
There's nothing stopping you.
You could live your worst life as well.
True.
That's right. Why am I here? Why are any of us here? These are questions we will not answer today. Unless...
Well, Nicholas, you work...
I do work.
At a place that we're going to talk about. So
I do
that's,
work
that's why
at a place.
Here.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, we're all about mecha around here. We're all about... And, you know, in America, we use mecha specifically to refer to humanoid machines, right?
Right.
But in Japan, it does just mean mechanism. It is just short for mechanism, and they use it for all manner of machinery. Usually military vehicles, that much is true, but non-military is also fine. It could, you know, it could include airplanes. It could include cars. It could include space probes.
Space.
And other spacecraft, which is why, of course, we have here a engineer from Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory.
Yes, hello. I'm Nick Cease, and I work for APL. We just call, you know, APL, Space Exploration Sector. Oh my, I have to do an actual disclaimer. Wow, that I'm not representing JHU-APL and my opinions are my own. I can't believe you forced me to be a genuine
human. This is
human
when I
for
asked
once.
You, I was like, I have, like, we will do almost any bit, but I was like, this one actually, you might say no, because you are actually might be legal trouble. I don't know.
No, it's not a bit. So the great thing, APL is very, it's very close to, like, where I grew up, right? I had never heard about it, and most people really haven't. They started in World War II, and basically they're, the claim to fame, it was like a super secret thing. They developed a fuse for missiles that could shoot down kamikazes because they didn't have like proximity fuses, basically. Like they didn't have proximity detectors.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, how do you shoot something down? Like you can't make your missile explode when you want it to, right? Stuff like that type of thing. APL did that. That was like their big thing. And now they're like, they do a lot of research stuff, so it's a university affiliated research center, a UARC, right? So it's not for profit. There's no like profit whatever. Like, you know, Grumman and Lockheed do similar things, of a very small subset of what APL does, but we're more like very research focused. We don't produce things, right? Like we make one or two of things ideally, and that's it. Move on to the next thing.
And APL does do some defense work.
Oh yeah, yep. The
so
Navy.
That's not like, you know.
Yeah,
your hands are relatively speaking clean as being Space Division, but you know,
we do some NSS things, but APL isn't like one of the capital DC defense contractors, and that like we don't build things. So it's a strange place, but it's. So, like, I have some lore here. I put down some lore because even, like, I learn new things. Every day, Sex, I learn new things. So we can start off by talking about the V2 sounding rocket. Germany made these V2 rockets in World War II, and the U.S. captured a bunch of these and used them for scientific purposes as sounding rockets, as they're called. And one of the things they did was shoot a camera higher than one has ever gone before. It was actually like a 35 millimeter film camera, just launched it straight up with an APL camera that took the first ever picture of Earth from space, which is pretty cool. Was in, I think, UC 1946.
Okay, sure.
And then they would go back up UC 1967 on Dodge. You'll hear a lot of acronyms. try to keep it straight. The Department of
Defense.
You're
technically wrong about UC, of course, because UC naturally takes place after Anno Domini.
Oh, I see. Okay. I see. After. It's like, wait. Okay.
There's a point in Anno Domini where we switch to UC.
I didn't know that was a thing. That was like a canon thing. Oh, at what point is it?
Great question.
Booty.
Excellent. So, Six, do you want to describe the V2 rocket? You have a beautiful picture here.
Sure. So UC starts in 2081 AD.
Oh, okay. We're getting there.
So the V2 rocket, we've had some moments on this show talking about how mechanical designers, especially certain ones, love to reference Nazi tech and World War II Germany. Well, this literally is Nazi tech, so that's awkward, right?
It's the origins, you know?
Right, but this is a vertically standing rocket. It has a, I believe, just a single thruster at the bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get a shot where it is not covered up, because a lot of these, obviously, it has, like, cowling and such that are blocking things out. No, yeah, it has
the
a
skirts.
Single thruster.
It has, you know, skirts at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. But basically, it has a triangular, traditionally warhead tip, though I'm sure it was filled with instrumentation in your sounding rocket, yours personally.
My personal sounding rocket.
Your own
personal. I was thinking the same thing. I hate it.
So you've got the nose cone here. On the sounding rocket, the tip is orange. We go down to sort of like a navy blue down below that for the rest of the nose cone. There's a little bit of striping there of sort of a lighter than a darker than a sort of medium, sort of in the middle between the two. Then we get to the main body of the rocket itself, which is white with a, what would you call this, sort of like a contained zigzag of
black.
Yeah,
like, triangles.
Yeah, yeah, interlocking triangles kind of pattern. Mm-hmm. Body tapers down a bit. We get four fins to help, you know, stabilize and steer. Mm-hmm. It does have spoilers on these, like there are, you know, maneuverability
spoiler
parts attached
alert
to this. Mm-hmm. And then there's a thruster at the bottom covered by the cowling, and it just you shoot it up and it turns and it comes back down.
That's what it does, and it, you know, it's a very simple object, and it does its job, from what I hear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At least mine does.
I mean, the APL one probably had better, had better specs, I would guess, because the original V2 had 2,200 pounds of explosives, mm-hmm. and y'all replaced it with 1,200 pounds of instrumentation. So that's a loss of 1,000
really?
Pounds. Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a very heavy payload. Wow.
I mean, they were shooting it at cities. They wanted to mess up cities.
That's, sure.
Yeah, pretty fucked up thing. It's one of those things, right, about, like, post-World War II, where we're like, how do we reappropriate this tech for good? And you're like, I mean, I guess you technically did, but...
I mean, we reappropriated engineers.
Yeah, but then we didn't do that. A lot of those not for good.
It did get us to the moon, but yeah.
Also it got us into some more nuclear research and stuff. It's a whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, oh, yeah. You know? But I know overall, like, as far as, obviously, the main V2 itself, very similar design, obviously, just the sort of weight and warhead are the primary differences. the payload, as it were. Mm-hmm. I will, of course, list the sounding rocket and the normal V2. You know, there's a variant, right?
That's right. Yep.
But that's, yeah, that's how we got our first pictures of the Earth.
I also, so I put the link to this YouTube video in here. Have you played it?
Yes, I've taken a look.
It's crazy.
It's pretty wild.
It's like a genuine just video. You don't often get those.
I really like the demonstration of just how, like, kind of terrifyingly stable this thing is. Because there's a point, like, obviously the camera is pointing backwards, right? Mm-hmm. At an angle. But you can see, like, the ignition of the engine. The thruster there. And it's sort of moving. And there's a point where it just locks. Where it's just like, oh, it's wobbling a little bit, but it is just pointing straight. It is just staring at Earth's horizon. Like, the screen is 50% Earth, 50% space. And then it makes the turn, it starts to spin again. But it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Fuck, man.
You know the crazy part?
I don't know the crazy part.
I don't
part.
Know if you knew. So there's some Nick lore to this as well. That I actually didn't even know. Like I said, I learned new things about APL. I didn't know they used a V2 or that they did this. So my great-grandfather was part of Project Paperclip and came over, you know, worked on the V2s. He made the, you know, worked on the gyroscope, like, nav system for the Saturn V. So may have worked on the, like, stabilization for the V2.
Wow.
So... small world.
If so, good job, I guess. Though also, gets easier in the upper atmosphere, doesn't it? You know, I guess it would get easier and harder because it's like there's less wind resistance, but also there's less wind for you to use the fins on, right?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I wonder.
Huh.
Smarter people than me think about that. But yeah. So that's the V2 in the first variants of the instruments. It doesn't even have a name at this point because it's just kind of experiments. Mm-hmm. You can get into, I don't think I have any here. There's some really tortured acronyms in, like, space probes and space instruments.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I learned this in a little bit of my homework.
Oh, but... yeah. Pepsi, Jedi. Well, those are actually pretty good, but yeah. It's
Pepsi fun. Is pretty good. You're right.
But, hey, this what episode doing, of Mechanista. Yeah. Well, shall we move on? To say that back in 67, we got the first photo picture, or color pictures, rather, of the Earth as well.
Yeah, this is from Dodge, the Department of Defense Gravitational Experiment.
Yeah.
So you can see... I thought you had the picture. It seems to be
The first one. It's the first one. The David Darling one.
Sure, but this is of the machine. I thought you had the photo, like the color photo. It's fine. I saw it.
Oh.
I get it back. Weird.
Yep. But yeah, it got the whole Earth too. Like, it's, you know, certainly stitched together as well, but it actually got, like, the full round Earth.
Yeah, it's a really wild shot because it is like the photo we have from the V2 obviously is just like a bunch of, well, we have the normal one, but the one that is the big one is sort of stitched together, right?
Yeah.
But this, as best as I can tell, is, as you say, just one shot here of, here it is, I'm posting it, and I'll put it in the show notes, of course, the fucking Earth.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it must have gotten far out there.
Yeah, and then... come back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that Kerbal Space Program has taught me is it's really easy to have an orbit that doesn't escape. A non-escaping orbit, very easy to do. You can get far out there and still come back down and crash.
Far out, man. Oh, you know what? It might have just downlinked it somehow. It did have a UHF radio. Not sure. Because it took film, obviously, but I wonder.
And you can, with the shot, the link there to a page that I found very useful, the Astronautics page, you can also see here's a color image of it.
Yeah.
Provided by the manufacturer.
By the manufacturer. So it's, as a spacecraft, it is a hexagon, right? I think it has some mm-hmm. solar panels along like the outer edges, a hexagonogram. Mm-hmm. And then the main telescope is just a big old cylinder. Oh,
of course, that's a telescope. Sure.
Yeah.
Just I mean,
there.
So is there like a high mobility version? Do we have like, is there like one with like more armor or ground equipment?
Probably, because, you know, well, it might have antenna that aren't deployed here. So it has a UHF band, so that's like fairly slow. So you want a larger antenna. So it could have that V, you know, that Gundam V.
Mm-hmm. And, it is kind of a miraculous thing, right? Thinking mm-hmm. about, you know, the design we talk about day in, day out on this podcast versus this, where it's like, you can build the most fragile shit in the world because when you're in space, I mean, you know, when you're close to Earth, we dump a lot of shit in orbit. There are some dangers there. But otherwise, it's like, this is nothing. You're not worried about it breaking.
Fragile in very certain ways, also sure, very sure. strong impact based. In other strange
impact things. Based fragile, right?
Well, so like when you do, you like qualify things for space, like you build the flight hardware, we call it, the thing that actually goes to space or flies, whatever. Mm-hmm. You do like testing on it. So APL has the Space Simulation Laboratory, which is like a facility that has massive vibration tables. Thermal vacuum chambers that can go down to almost as cold as space, which isn't really a thing, but and stuff like that. So you do like you can really shake these things or do a shock test where you literally like hit something with a hammer. But then there is like it's not here, but you've seen like the moon lander, right? Like the stereotypical moon lander.
Sure. Well, and the Apollo mission one anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got the gold like.
The gold foil.
And everything. That's literally just capped on tape. So it's just like capped on film. It's very just... it is not strong, as you said. That would be one very flimsy thing. Yeah. So it's a strange design. Yeah.
Worth noting that both Dodge here, which we're talking about, and the upcoming... the one we're about to talk about next, are... these are, you know, these are probes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as such, they don't have any get up and go, right? They just kind of, they're for the most part, they are rocks with cameras on them. And I mean that in the propellant sense. I mean, I know they have a little, but.
I don't know what, so they could have reaction wheels, right? Those might be a little advanced. That's where like you use like a bunch of spinning stuff to point. Because if you're, you know, if you're in weightless space, you know, Ender's Game, how do you move, right? Because. Equal and opposite reactions. Well, you have to play games with momentum, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, APL, I think, was the first to do this, so I didn't put it on here. If you're in the Earth's like general vicinity, right? The Earth has a magnetic field. If you just have magnets in the right spot, the Earth can just like take you. You just like go with the Earth in certain ways. So you can kind of stabilize yourself with passive magnets.
Oh, so this is very interesting. So no, it doesn't appear that it had reaction wheels. It used gravity gradient stabilization, which is, I don't know, this I guess I would assume they don't really use this much anymore, so I don't know if you're going to be super familiar with it. But basically, it is like weights on wires that you deploy at tactical times to take advantage of the gravitational force of tides. Which is wild.
That sounds fake. It sounds like a Gundam thing.
Basically, they say they were able to stabilize it after 12 days. Because it's like, the tides are high. Throw out the fishing weight.
Yeah, playing games with momentum and gravity and magnets.
Some
creative problem solving.
Yeah. That's wild. Yeah. But yeah, these are launched since they don't have any way of breaking Earth's gravity themselves. Mm-hmm. These were launched via the Titan program, and I think that primarily we're going to be talking about the Titan 3. The 3C is the one they designate, but the 3 family is in general pretty similar. So this is, as best as I can tell, this is a single like tower of a rocket of liquid fuel, with it looks like a four thruster nozzle engine at the bottom, and on the side you have two solid fuel boosters just to help with the initial get up and go. Solid fuel boosters. If you play Kerbal, you know the drill. But the wonderful thing about these, their like thrust to weight ratio is fantastic. But they are firecrackers. You turn them on and they just go. Yeah. Like once you have turned them on, it's like, okay, the reaction is happening. My hands are off the controls. I can't do anything anymore. So as far as I'm aware, not really used much for maneuvers. Just for
not quite. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they have all the variants down below. Oh, that's very interesting. So they've got at astronautics.com. If we're ready to go into the visuals here, starting with the Titan 3C, as you described, and it's got a very triangular nose, it's got like a hood almost, like a little dunce cap.
I wouldn't call it that. That's kind of hurtful, but otherwise, I understand.
A spearhead, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The Titan 3C. I mean, speaking of hurtful, we move on to the Titan 3 small. Listen, it's true. Not the size. It's where you point it. Which is largely similar. Maybe it's just the main 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 segment solid. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 segment solid. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard, you know, without scale.
It does seem like it's just sort of the upper layer. So, I should note, like, I make a lot of assumptions based on Kerbal, which is, I know, unhealthy, but also it is like based on at least aesthetics and the physics that are real.
Yeah.
And based on those aesthetics, which are, you know, drawn from Soviet and American rocket programs and, you know, Russian ones too, but, you know, it seems to me like the 3C, like right above where the solid fuel boosters stop, there's a decoupler. And from that point down, on the 3C and the 3 small, they are pretty much identical. It is that upper section that has changed, whereas the 3C seems to have like sort of another stage up there, whereas the small doesn't really.
Yeah. And I'm seeing now there's another diagram, the Titan 3 LV, which looks very similar to the 3C. There's something going on down underneath with a solid stage. I can't quite tell what that might be. But the thing on the top, that's a space plane. It's supposed to be a space plane.
Sure. Yeah. So explain to me and maybe the listener, though, maybe the listener already knows, space plane has always been a distinction that is like, okay, like, is the space shuttle program, are those space planes? What makes something a space plane?
No, though, now that you say it, I think. What? Okay. There. I forget what it is, but a space plane is something that couldn't take off, but it can go higher than regular airplanes. So you essentially need to launch it somehow. We have planes, I forget all the specifics now, but there are aeroplanes, large aeroplanes, which...
Is it just like the spacecraft version of a middle manager? Like, it needs people on either side of it. It can't do shit. But in the middle, boy. Gonna be glad you got that space plane.
It really is like a plane style, right? So it's, you know, designed for space. It's upper atmosphere, right? It can't get there on its own. But you can have another plane, like, get it pretty high and then drop it. And then it goes.
Okay.
And that's its thing. So not the space shuttle isn't really the space shuttle does land, but
and it can fully go into space.
Yeah, but it can't really fly.
I see. I mean, it does have like
it can fall wings. Very well. Yeah.
Okay. So, but it can't like it could. You don't think the space shuttle could glide? It's too heavy for that.
I mean, technically, it glides. You know, and infinitely more than most. Barely anything returns, but yeah. Than a capsule, yeah. For sure. Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting is we talk all this this game about like looking at this and what it is, but there's a lot of information and there's also no information, right?
Yeah.
Right? Where it's like, there's a ton of information here. I could tell you that the Titan like 3A2 has a gross mass of 29,188 kilograms, empty mass, thrust, ISP, burn time, diameter, span. But like, you don't go from like, oh, from the 3C to the 3LV and it says, oh, and we've improved the, like, the electronics. You don't get that kind of breakdown here, because that's not who they're targeting with this information.
And also, to like, this is a fairly old, you know, system. It's hard to get that information if it ever existed outside of people's heads.
Right, right.
In my head.
I mean, I'm sure there were pieces of paper, but, you know.
Sure.
Enough people working on these programs, you did have to write. You couldn't, unfortunately, you cannot do space programs based on oral tradition.
Listen, but it was a different time back then, let me tell you.
True.
You see, now we have different problems in that the information probably is all there. You would never be able to find it on all the paperwork.
Yeah.
If you just came in, you know, apocalypse situation and found it all.
But yeah, our next satellite, this one actually is a satellite. The others have been probes, more or less, which is another APL project launched on a Titan 3C, is Transit, which is a system that people may not realize how much they fucking rely on.
So there's a backstory to this. There's a few people who claim this, right? But so Sputnik, the first satellite, technically, right?
Yes.
There were two guys at APL, and like APL basically had a radio club, right? Shocker. Sure. Nerds.
Yeah.
We probably still do. And I think, yeah. Anyway, so they borrowed like some equipment from the radio club, right? Because Sputnik was just kind of like pinging in space, right? That's what it was doing. It was just kind of orbiting and ping, ping with like a radio signal.
Yes. Sputnik was very important as far as like showing what could be done. Mm-hmm. Is a very useful proof of concept and test of theory. Mostly what the satellite itself did was go, hi. Just, you know,
I'm over here. Now I'm over here. Yeah. Which, so, you know, these two guys at APL, they're like, hey, we found Sputnik. And then, like, it's, you know, a research place, bunch of cool nerdy people. They're like, hey, Doppler shift is a thing, which, if you don't know, is basically if you have a wave coming at you, the frequency looks different if it's coming towards you or away from you based on speed. So it's, you know, red shift or blue shift, they call it.
Same theory as I mean, you know, the sound version of it, people are familiar with the Doppler effect of, you know, car driving past you going, that thing.
Yeah, exactly. So if Sputnik keeps saying hello, it could be saying hello. And if you just measure that, then you can know where Sputnik is. Like, you can do satellite tracking. So that was basically reverse GPS. It was tracking a satellite based on the satellite signal.
Uh-huh.
And so there's like, if we do that.
Yeah, it's just director Frank McClure was like, why don't we do it the other way and make it useful?
Fucking use it for something. So yeah, that's what Transit is. It's also NavSat or NSS. Gotta have an acronym. Navy Navigation Satellite System. SatNav. It was, you know, the first type of GPS, global positioning system, using satellites to navigate. And this guy, we've got some good pictures of.
Oh yeah. Some great, you know, it also helps that there were 41 of these fuckers. So we got some documentation on
these. We either have one, maybe a replica in the SSL, the Space Sim Laboratory. Often we have to do shift work we have to run 24/7 when you're really doing a test. There's one of those like in the control room. So I've seen this, the completed thing before. It's like a big ball.
Oh, that's great.
Right.
Yeah, I guess that's a fairly good description. It's it's really like, I assume it's ornamental, kind of cute the way it has this like white spiral painted around it. There's no way that does anything,
unless.
I mean, sure, unless, but like,
I don't know.
Yeah,
it's a good question. That is a good question.
We also have on the Wikipedia page, we have some art that is not labeled as art, which annoys me, but we have some art of what one would look like in operation. Obviously, it has solar panels extended here. Also, though, we see those weights I was talking about. Yeah. There's one of those weights extended to help it, you know, very gradually adjust its position.
Yeah, it's crazy. We have this picture up on like posters and stuff. I've seen it before.
Yeah, it's a good one. So, yeah. So first of all, what was APL's role in this beyond being like, hey, this is possible, obviously?
Oh, APL built this.
Okay, great. All the instrumentation?
Yep. Well, as far as I developed jointly by DARPA and JGPL. The details, I don't know, but we have like a bunch of stuff at APL.
So, and JPL, we haven't mentioned JPL so far. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory, you're like smarter, hotter older brother, right?
It's because they're fucking right by say. So yeah, whenever you hear APL, people do know JPL more. So like, oh, you know, you work at JPL. I don't know. JPL was in The Martian or some shit. It's not the same thing at all. I don't know the history of JPL.
I notice how much more reticent you are to say some of the things you've said in private here on the podcast. There's been a lack of respect, which, you know, I don't know. I assume is well-grounded.
It's, you know, whenever you're the prime versus the subcontractor, you deal with like a lot of management and stuff. So, you know, people, organizations can sometimes, you know, like seem to be jerks to one another.
Sure.
And so what we'll talk about later, what I'm the most qualified to talk about is an instrument on the Europa mission, which is the upcoming, hopefully 2024 launch to go to one of Saturn's moons, Europa, and orbit it a bunch. That is JPL. It is a mega mission, many billions. So it's quite a feat. They have a lot of work left to do.
I mean, would you say, do you think this is a fair characterization that JPL being higher profile and also much bigger, there's perhaps a greater spread of the quality of their work? Is that the fair way to put it?
It's just like, not that people knows. Well, our space sector is only like 1,000 people. They don't have, there's like very different groups within it, right? Because it's so big. Mm-hmm. There isn't just like one group that is JPL that you deal with or that like runs things, right?
I mean, there's one group that I deal with, but I understand your point.
Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't worked with them long enough.
By the numbers, it seems like between full-time employees and contractors, they have close to 10,000 people, which is fucking wild.
Yeah.
Yep. Also graduate cool students. Okay, if you're letting graduate students come in, no wonder your shit sucks.
Listen, grad students probably build everything.
I know. Yeah. I don't know. It's just wild to look at this thing. Like, I mean, you see the image of the Transit 1 satellite prototype here. Mm-hmm. And it is just like, I don't know, this is a personal comparison, but I feel like enough people will know it that it gives a sense of scale. You know the like the concrete like red balls they put out front of targets?
Oh, yeah.
That's about the scale we're talking
about.
It
is, yeah.
And it's just kind of wild what these things can do based on that.
And then it explodes into that thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
All right, so let's see what. So moving on, we'll go through these two fast, because other things that you may have heard about of note before we get to DART. New Horizons was an APL mission. It was the first of the New Horizon. It was the first of a new mission class that may be called New Horizon. But it took it sent that amazing picture of Pluto. We've never had pictures of Pluto, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, wait, it's not blue? Yeah. So we took a picture of that. And then this is the thing that flew by the asteroid that people, you know, called BB-8, Ultima Thule. Thule? How do you think you say that? I should know.
I would say Thule, but I'm not certain. Whatever you would call it, that's not its name anymore. These days it is 486958 Arakoth.
Oh, Arakoth. Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is apparently the oldest, the farthest and most primitive object in the solar system to be visited by a spacecraft. Thanks, New Horizon, swinging by and saying hi.
Yeah, so let's take a look at New Horizons.
Yeah, so this, also, this is one of the ones where finally we have some, like, really, like, high budget coverage of this thing.
Yeah.
NASA has a page where they have, like, a 3D simulation of New Horizons' exact position with a 3D model.
And you can, like, move it around, yeah.
Which, also, this is another one of those moments. You see the gray cylinder with like the like the prongs coming off of it, that is exactly like, I mean, it's slightly different details, but that is exactly like a Kerbal Space Program radiator model, so I assume that's a radiator.
What do you mean by radiator? Like something that radiates heat away? Yes. It is the opposite.
Really?
That's the RTG. That's the nuclear generator. A radioisotope thermal generator is the nuclear power source that sometimes spacecraft use.
Oh, you know what? No, I was getting it. That is a generator in Kerbal. I was getting it.
Okay. It probably looks, you know, fins and stuff, but it would be black.
Well, so it's a nuclear generator, you're saying, right?
Yep.
Why is that allowed? Because my understanding was that nuclear reactions are not allowed in space by international treaty.
Well, so there's, this is great, it's very kind of specific, is a big thing on Europa too. There's a lot of work and protection, a thing called planetary protection is a legitimate thing with people with legitimate jobs called, you know, planetary protection, lead planetary protection engineer. You are, of things you're not supposed to do, right? You don't want to contaminate planets, especially if there's life, you know, stuff like that. You have to have ultra, ultra clean things if you're going around places that you like want to detect life, right? And you're not allowed, I don't know all the rules because there's so many now, you're basically not allowed to smash radioactive stuff into planets or like, you know, the risk of that. So on a lander, you generally are not, you know, discouraged from doing that, I believe.
So basically they had to like pinky swear it wouldn't crash.
It's all, you know, risks and stuff. But, sure. Well, and this is a probe that, you know, isn't going. It's not a lander. But
it's of the sort of Voyager style of, like, throw it into space and it'll just keep going and eventually we'll lose the signal, right?
Yeah. And the thing is, as you get farther and farther away from the sun, your solar panels start to do less and less, right? It falls off by R cubed. Yeah. The farther you're away, the energy you get, right? Because it's the radius as it keeps going. So you need some other way to generate energy, and so you got to use nukes, essentially.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
Yeah.
I
mean, the main body is basically a satellite, so it's got like a big white dish. A satellite dish. It's a big white cone, right, with a structure in the middle for the reflector and the transmitter and everything. And then it's kind of like this triangle. Yeah, like blocky triangle type body underneath.
Sort of like
it.
Some of the corners are shaved off, but yeah.
With, you know, little bits of protrusion and stuff like that. It's gold. It's all coated in Kapton.
I really, really love, like, God bless whoever made this, because there's a dedication to, like, to truth. As you say, it's this gold foil all around. And then if you look at the bottom, they have modeled the duct tape. I assume it's not, like, it's, you know, space duct tape, but it's just tape.
Let me see. Where
is holding it down.
Where is it?
If you're on the NASA page, there's the live shot, but also you can go down and see just the model viewer.
Okay.
And if you flip it to the bottom.
Oh, around the circle.
Tape on there.
Around the circle part? Oh, yeah. That's. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's wrinkled. Like, that's probably aluminum tape. Yeah. That's almost certainly
that's
aluminum
wild.
Conductive tape. One of those tabs were interesting. Yep. Listen, you'd be surprised. So that gold stuff is capped. It's polyimide, aka Kapton, which is a thing we use all the time in space because it's really resistant to heat, doesn't off gas and stuff like that. I use Kapton tape all the time. It's just kind of like a plastic little thing. It's not super strong to like rip. I just literally use a tape dispenser, and that's just Kapton sheets, polyimide sheets over the whole thing. It's not like some super durable coating or anything. Durable in the ways, you know, we usually think of.
And is it just sending back radio waves? Is it just like using like algorithmic like understanding of where Earth must be and shooting back radio waves? Or
digital to transmit. Like, oh yeah. Yep. So that is that's high gain antenna. It probably doesn't have a low gain because what would it use? So that's its high gain. Whenever you see a big dish like that, it's to be extremely directional. Call it high gain because it's just, you know, a little point vector ideally back to APL. Because we have a giant dish at APL, I think, that does ops for New Horizons. That's its goal. So it needs to know it's pointing very well. I don't know which it is, but there is a, they call it the star sensor or the like star tracker, that's right, to know where it is, to like align itself to stars so it knows which way to point.
Wow.
Yeah, and so at the tip of the triangle is the RTG, which is just a big big gray cylinder that's almost as big as the dish.
So your business specifically, you, Nicholas.
Yes.
You're into creating the instruments, right?
Yeah. You know, P6 famously says, yo, Nick, the rocket scientist. Well.
Yeah. It's very reductive. It's wildly reductive.
Well, everybody's, you know, it's, yeah. Sure. So, and I prefer this. I don't build the spacecraft, right? I don't build the car. I build what goes on the car. So I build the boxes that go on the space probes that are kind of the point of them, that that do the science, that sense things. They call them, you know, instruments because they sense things.
Right.
And so we're getting into the instruments here. We'll start with cameras. Cameras are a big business for us, optical stuff.
Okay, so, all right, so you take a photosensitive piece of paper.
Yep.
And you poke a hole, and that's it. Can I have your job now?
You got to put your iPhones in there.
Oh, okay. All right. You got to take a picture of the picture with your iPhone and then send it back.
Yep. Yeah, so this probably isn't the first one. But a design we've kind of used a lot is, we'll begin with LORI here, the Long Range Reconnaissance Imager, getting into our real acronym phase here. And so we've got a picture here. The main body of a telescope, you'll be shocked to know, is a cylinder. It's a large diameter cylinder. There's no good scale here for you. We'll see some scale
later. It's because this is the variant we've got here. Mm-hmm. I love the fucking elven one you've got this time. The Lucy Laurie. The apostrophe Laurie.
Yeah.
that's great.
Yeah. So Laurie is on New Horizons. Laurie is on New Horizons. And then, you know, you repropose. There's a kind of a funny thing that you can propose they call it build to print. So you're like, oh, we'll just make this thing we already made. It never works out that way. But that's the thing you propose because it's like, we'll save so much money. We just build this thing we already made. You don't have to do new development or anything. Yeah, okay. That totally works all the time. There are challenges with doing that. So, yeah, like that's, you know, that's a telescope at the core of it. And so on the left, this is a really good picture, right? Because the left part, it's the structure without kind of the baffle on, without the cylinder on. So you see it has like a circular circle housing at the front, and then it has these arms that go down. And that's the detector on the left, the actual thing that does the sensing. And you see it's kind of pointing outwards up and to the right. So you can have a bunch of different stuff in there too, right? Like you can have mirrors, you can do focusing, you cannot do focusing, depending on, you know, what angle do you want, right? Do you want a narrow angle lens, wide angle? What colors do you want, basically, right? What wavelengths of not just light, you know, you can do
like IR red or blue. What colors do you want today?
Hey, what colors do you want? So that's it. And then let's open some of these. So Lucy Laurie has some better pictures, and this is more recent on the Lucy mission. That's what it's called. It's called Lucy Laurie. So if you go to the first page, there's a really nice picture here. The nice color
what links
one
are you
here.
Clicking?
Let's do the first one
here. The first one relative to what?
Well, under, you know, we're in the same Google Doc here. I just highlighted it.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That's on me.
It's okay. Yeah, this has really nice pictures. We try to do, you know, photo ops occasionally, you know, good publicity. So there's Lucy Lawyer. You can see the detector down there. And then it's got these annular rings. It has these baffles for like stray light rejection and stuff. I'm not an optical engineer. My office mate is, but it's complicated. I don't know a lot about how our cameras work. We've invested heavily in this new like optical facility to do calibration and like focusing. You can shim things different ways to change. When you're taking pictures of so far away, you have extreme telescopic cameras sometimes. It's
and like incredibly in hard. Normal photography to take a good image, you want to maximize the quality of the like the actual like light that is coming to you and filter it as best you can before doing anything digital, because digital is always just like cutting away, right? And I can only imagine how much more that's the case with these.
You want to capture every, you don't want to filter, you want to,
well, but I mean like you're talking about but I mean talking like blocking bad light is the thing you mentioned, right?
Oh, so things that like, you know, if you get if J.J. Abrams, you know, is filming in space, right? He just has lens flares everywhere. Then the scientists aren't going to get to see what they want to see. You're not going to get that beautiful BB-8 picture or whatever, right? So it's that type of thing. But you generally don't want to filter.
Sure, sorry.
You do filter. That's the thing. Like, there will be specific objectives and, like, things you want the camera to be good at. That's a big challenge. Big thing people work on. That's true. And then if you go on, so there's the first scale on the second picture. If you click to the right, there's the scale of it. It, you'd say 3 feet high, maybe.
Yeah, that sounds maybe 2.5, but yeah, somewhere around there.
Yep. So this is in one of our clean rooms. This is our fancy optical facility.
Currently putting a shower cap on it.
Yep. You'd be surprised how. Listen, like, you know, you say, oh, you're a rocket scientist, and, you guys work for NASA, you do fancy stuff, which is all true, and I love my job. It's great. You know, it's a job like anything else. There's challenges and stress. But once you're in the factory and you see how the sausage is made, you're like, well, I guess, of course, it's just, and I tell people, it's just, you know, meat people put these things together, right? In the end, it's just some guy putting on the rocket bolts, right? There's just a dude with a wrench who puts things on. It's an interesting perspective. So there's just that other picture, and there's just another picture showing a rendering there, so no new info there, which brings us to another variant. So there's Lori. There's the variant that is Lucy Lori, and then Draco is also very similar in terms of, you know, it's a telescope. But you can see the rendering on our first picture. Do you have that one up?
Yeah, this doesn't look too I mean, I guess there's no reason to tinker with things like the outside if you've got that locked down, but it looks fairly similar.
It does, and I think that's the thing. You know, a telescope, you want to have the detector somewhere, and often you want to have a bunch of stuff in front of it, right? Like, if you think of telephoto lenses, they get really big, right?
True.
For focusing and the way light works and you bend it reasons. So, you know, you can change the size, but what are you going to really do with the outside? I'm not sure what you do. It's really all the guts on the inside that do everything. And you can see the inside baffles are different. The stuff that's inside is different. I don't think that's a beam cannon in the middle, but it kind of looks like it would shoot something. And I can't really tell you what's different. But this has mounting features that, you know, make it look a little cooler, right? It has these kind of a tripod situation going on towards the front of the camera.
Sure, it's got landing gear. It can land on the moon itself.
Exactly. And the second picture is it actually on the bench. I know which bench this is. And so it's coated with Mylar, you know, that stuff that just looks like aluminum foil. It's fancy aluminum foil.
What? So this one is silver. Why is it silver sometimes and gold sometimes? You can say no reason. There's no reason.
There is. Usually you use this Mylar and then you wrap it in Kapton.
It's Mylar versus Kapton. My mistake. Yes.
Well, often you overwrap Mylar with Kapton. I think this should be Mylar. Yeah. This is very thermally reflective, is the thing. So, you know, space gets really cold and you can get really hot. Also, you can get really... Sometimes you want to be rejecting or accepting heat. So blanketing is a big thing. In this case, if you blanket it with something reflective, it won't heat up as much. But I think we'll see on PIMS later, our cups are actually black because we want at certain points to absorb and then also radiate. It's a whole thing. But you see here, so it's all shiny now. It's on a stand here. That's what it looks like.
Yeah. May I say, looking at it covered in foil, I am actually not having difficulty believing a person made this.
Exactly. Well, the funny part is, so see... Oh, here, you want to know the sausage? So this is on a flow bench, we call it, because you see those things behind it? There are HEPA filters and fans there, because a great way to keep things clean is to just blow air in front of it. So if you're sitting at this bench, right, as long as you blow air towards you, your skin particles aren't going to move against the wind, right?
Sure.
So that's like a way to keep things clean. And optical instruments especially is very important to keep them clean, right? You don't want dust on your lens. And so you can see on the right, there are tweezers there on top of a clean room wipe, which is just like a lint-free wipe cloth, right? To clean things in a clean room. And then you can see the rest of the table. Let's go to the left of the picture. That little gold fleck. Do you see that? That is a little bit of dirty Kapton tape. So, and that we get, there's a lot of those because you're just, listen, it comes out of a tape dispenser. Sometimes, you know, you get little bits of tape. And then you can see the table is dirty. It looks dirty. That is aluminum oxide because this thing is on an aluminum stand, basically, because it's upside down right now. And the way these electrostatic safe benchtops, whatever the material is, when you move aluminum on it, it kind of like, it gets dirty, and that's just kind of like aluminum oxide that's on the bench. So it looks dirty in this picture.
And it technically is, but like not in a way that matters, you know.
No, but yeah, it's funny. There's the sausage. And Draco is, of course, let's see, did I put pictures of Dart down here? Yes. So Draco is what the camera is called, which is, of course, the Dart. I lost it. Didymos Reconnaissance and Asteroid Camera. I don't know where the O comes from. Anyways, so that is on the DART mission, which is another thing I have to mention because that's the highest publicity thing I can imagine we do for a long time. DART, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, which is NASA's first planetary defense mission, just completed completed its mission, which is funny.
This is one you probably have heard of, I'm going to say, listener.
Yeah, the highest likelihood of having heard of. So this was a whole APL mission. APL made the spacecraft and everything. That was a satellite that... Six, can you cue Beyond the Time now? Beyond Time? Wait, what is it?
Beyond the Time. You got
Beyond the Time. Yeah, cue Beyond the Time now. Because its whole idea was... Listen, you know, you've seen the movie Armageddon. Where an asteroid's going to come and slam into the Earth, and Bruce Willis has to go up and blow it up.
I mean, obviously around here, Beyond the Time, the reference because of Char's counterattack, but yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. See, I didn't have to explain it, because its whole job is to move an asteroid. So like, hey, if we saw an asteroid coming that we didn't want to hit Earth, could we, you know, shoot a thing at it from far enough away that you don't need a nuke, right? If you just nudge something really far away, right, the cue ball... If you just slightly fuck up on your cue, your pool shot, right, it goes way off course. So that was the goal of this. And so go ahead.
I have the utmost respect for the work y'all do over at APL. I was always under the impression, right, that this was kind of... It was like Sputnik, right? It's like, I mean, we know we can do this. We should do it just to show that we can. But, like, of course this will work.
I knew this was coming. Yeah. And that's the, so, and we were, you know, joking at the lunch table, like, you know, what is the outcome of this? It's high school physics. It's inelastic and elastic collisions.
Uh-huh.
Which is the thing. So you're absolutely right. But then you think about, well, it is space, and it is incredibly far away, and moving at, what, I think 40,000 miles an hour or something.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. And that's the thing. It's not that easy. It is that easy.
Oh, I mean, it's not. I'm not. It's the test, though, like, seems like it is of your ability to be this freaking accurate.
Basically. Right? And know what will happen. Like, to know the physics of, like, okay, how much are we going to move with what mass? You know, P equals MV. Mm-hmm. Sorry, momentum is mass times velocity, right? And then you know right. direction. And so, interestingly, we'll describe it here in a sec, but the asteroid it slammed into, there were two, that's why it was called Double, so you could see, like, the gravitational difference.
Wait, you got two with one hit? That's impressive.
It was really easy to tell how we knocked it off course or not, based on, like, looking at, you know, them orbiting each other, kind of.
Uh-huh.
That's why. What was I saying? So, there were different, it took a while to get data back, right? But some other telescopes were looking at this, obviously, they want to capture it. And uh-huh. there was a lot more dust than they thought. So it actually wasn't really how they expected.
Huh.
Basically, the you know, there's dust can just cling together, right? And that's like
sure.
a comet, that's a meteor, whatever. And so I think it was much more dust than they anticipated, because you could see a big bloom.
So, like, the asteroid y'all hit was just much less densely packed than y'all expected.
Yeah. So, like, you don't necessarily know its mass, I guess. That's the.
I mean,
the
you can only, you know, I. This is the most ignorant position for me to say this from, but it seems like, I mean, I am always impressed with how much they can tell by pointing a telescope at something, but it isn't infinite information. There is a limit.
Telescope, you know, radio, infrared. It's. Yeah. So, going to the satellite, it's not necessarily anything spectacular in terms of like innovation on the satellite, but it looks cool. So, you see the first picture here is they're putting it on a stand for some reason, probably in SpaceX, which SpaceX did the launch vehicle. On the right, or either side, on this right side, you can see the curled up solar array, which is really cool. That's the whole giant solar array.
With those, like, that sort of, like, like the copper mat. Color with, like, brand, like, brown, like, belts holding it shut.
Yeah. That's you know, has to unfurl to super long. Uh-huh. And on the bottom, it has, you know, the mounting features that probably match the spacecraft. On the bottom, there are some instruments there. So there's a red tag cover, we call it, on there. I don't know what instrument that is, but that's something that you take off before flight. Red tag, as in, like, do not fly with this thing on, because, I don't know, you didn't take the cover off your camera or something. And do you
Why
see
don't you just use explosive bolts or something to take it off?
So, that's we safe, actually right? do. We actually do pyro bolts.
Ooh.
Sometimes, for, like, if you want to one-time fire things, right? A mechanism in space is very heavy and can be, like, a risk that it doesn't work. And it takes power. So you can just have a pyro bolt.
That's dope.
Yeah. Yeah. Explosion. And there's a lot of Kapton. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we have a shot here of the solar panel fully deployed?
I think I did. Well, you can't actually have a... picture,
I mean,
picture, but I think
sure,
the last
sure.
one does.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. Look at that thing.
Yeah. Because, I mean, obviously you need big solar panels. Well, if people don't, you need giant solar panels and able to have enough energy to run. I mean, spacecraft, incredibly low power, like insanely low power, but the larger the better. And so these things are really long. I think Europa is the size of like a basketball court. It's insane.
It's wild.
Yes, a little body here, and then those two asteroids. Oh, and there's its little friend to the right. It had a little, you know, baby satellite on it that could, you know, watch DART impact, which I love.
Sure,
just
you detach
like,
it goodbye, like shortly friend. Before impact so it can take pictures?
Yep.
That makes sense.
Take pictures or track or whatever. But uh-huh. Draco, so look, I can't tell you what's different about Draco, which was the camera, but the images you were all were seeing, like on the news or wherever, were from Draco, of it approaching the asteroid and then eventually hitting it. Those were, that's Draco. And I didn't work on that one directly, but like, you know, the people I work with do and talk with did in my small group. And it was very cool. We had a massive event and everything. It's like, yeah, this is like, you don't usually get a countdown like this to your science payoff or whatever.
Sure.
And it was wild. I can't believe, like, it kept taking pictures incredibly close. And then if you know, like the last frame was like, you know, mostly red. There was a top few lines. They must have been just screaming out these lines. They did low resolution too. Like, it has higher resolution, but to go as fast as possible, they had low. And it looks like a failed like test in the lab, like running on your laptop or whatever, because, you know, the rest got corrupted. And it's like, well, the rest didn't get corrupted. It turned to dust.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, very, very cool wild. Mission. The design, you know, it's nothing spectacular, but it moved that meteor. Move that meteor. All right, we gotta go to Europa now.
And so, do you want to do Parker last?
Because
Europa seems like a showstopper.
It does. You're right. Let's talk about Parker Solar Probe, which was called Solar Probe Plus for a while, so it's known by that name as well. PSP, though, that's also a really cool mission. I don't know if we have a picture of it specifically here, no. But it is water-cooled, which is very strange, because, I mean, water in space, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it wouldn't be frozen because whatever it's doing is hot enough for that to be useful, right?
Well, kind of. I mean, yes and no, right? Like, because you're not immediately going to be that hot. I don't know the full specifics of it, but they really needed that. The design of this thing was like, they had a lot of problems to solve. So if we go to the middle picture here, you can see at the top, we can describe it. It's a big like white square type thing. Like,
oh, y'all have
square.
A great website for this. ParkerSolarProbe.jhuapl.edu. This is great. Look at this. Some very, very... close-up renders. Unfortunately, I don't see a way to pause the video at strategic times where you can see the probe really well, which would be very nice if you could just talk to your bosses about that.
Yeah, we'll just do that. But yeah, so starting from like the top, it's, you know, a white, this thing is a heat shield thing that kind of is larger than the rest of the spacecraft behind it. It's on a structure far, you know, getting it far away from the rest of the spacecraft. It's got some panels on the side, I think, or it's solar. I don't know what those are. Those might be radiators. And then it's kind of the bulk of the spacecraft underneath. You can't see, with all the mylar and whatever is on, you can't see it really well. But, you know, it's a cylinder-bodied spacecraft with a bunch of shit on it. So it's got a whole array of instruments. It's got radios. The thing, this will be a good segue, but, oh yeah, there you go. That's a good one. This heat shield is like extremely new. They had to develop it because this thing gets incredibly close to the sun.
Right. Like, this is like, I mean, you know, my understanding of, because it's such a pain in the ass to do these missions, because it's so expensive and so much work, you rarely do it for like one piece of data, right? That's not how this works. But the primary point of interest is this, is how close it can get to the sun in this sick new heat shield, right?
Well, that's how you're able to do the science. Yeah.
Right.
Just trying to do it isn't the point, but yeah.
Sure. Sure.
That's the whole reason for it and what the science it can get from that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is insane how close it gets. Yeah. One of the instruments you can see on there is a little cup. If you like look on the side, a little cup that faces towards like the side of the heat shield.
Sure. Yeah.
So that is a Faraday cup. It's a type of instrument that senses plasma. And so it's, you know, literally sensing the sun's plasma sticking out so it can actually get it. That thing gets crazy hot. It's crazy materials.
Wow.
And they did, for whatever reason, they have a good shot of like looking at it with UV light and lasers and stuff in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe contamination. Couldn't tell you. But if we move on to Europa, the Europa mission.
So this is the one where we were talking about actually doing this. I looked into this machine, and I believe what I messaged you is like, this seems wildly optimistic. The Europa Clipper.
Yeah, so it's called Clipper because it like makes it like zooms in and out of Europa's atmosphere, basically. If you imagine that, like, it does petals, we call it, because it's literally like making a petal shape, like a heavy pointed ellipsoid around Europa for many flybys. And there's a reason Europa is very challenging. It's going to Jupiter, right? Jupiter's massive. It's fucking huge. It's crazy. Has incredibly intense magnetic field and like radiation around it, right? And a big challenge in space electronics is radiation. Like, if you just fly consumer electronics, they die very quickly. They just can't handle the radiation. And Europa, well, the Europa mission has insanely high radiation for what we're used to. Like, materials testing, it's up to the gigarads, which means nothing without context, but crazy high radiation, which is a thing that we're interested in measuring, but it also makes things incredibly challenging. And we have very tight planetary protection recalling requirements.
Mm-hmm.
How clean things have to be, basically. But yeah, there, this is an expensive thing that is designed to get a lot of science.
On the plus side, with that much radiation, you don't need any source of power, right?
Yeah, you just hook this up.
There you go. This is a joke. Obviously not how how nuclear generators actually work.
I mean, there is a way you could do that. It just is, it would be hard. If you had a giant loop, you would get a lot of current through that loop. I wonder. There's definitely a concept of this.
Huh.
Probably makes no sense to do, but you could do it. Yeah. So I guess we should start with the knack and the whack.
Sure.
So one last camera we have, two really, the ICE Whack and Knack, which is the Europa Imaging System. And that's the wide angle camera and narrow angle camera. These are two instruments built at APL. The Whack has been delivered to JPL, but the Knack is actually still undergoing testing as we speak, hopefully done by the end of the year, as in like December 21st or 4th, and people can go home. We'll see. Who knows? These are, let's see, I think if we go to the Knack looks most like the rest of the cameras, right? It's a narrow angle camera. It's not designed to be, you know, a big fisheye. Where did it open this link? Okay, it didn't open this link. Oh, it's downloaded the picture. Interesting. But so you can see it's that typical cylindrical body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it has this little feature on the left, the like top left, you see, right? That is the cover. So that is the thing that you deploy at Europa so that you're clean up until that point. That's the point of that. But it's not just bolted to the spacecraft. It's on a gimbal. So that thing it's on is a like three-axis gimbal.
What the fuck is a gimbal? I don't know. Like, I've heard this and I know I should know it, but I don't know what the fuck a gimbal is.
So you know like camera equipment, like stabilizer?
Sure.
It's that. So it's like
I see.
So along the axis of like that cylinder on the left, if you imagine like an axis going through the camera, like an axle, right? Okay. It can rotate that way. It can also rotate perpendicular to that. It's basically so you can move.
It's just rotation. A means of rotation.
Right, but rotation in 2 degrees of freedom. So like phi
and theta. I see. Okay. Okay.
That's basically what a gimbal is at the core of it. But that's what that's on. So it is on a gimbal so that as you fly by Europa, you can track the planet ideally. So you don't, you know, just get one shot. Like, okay, we got to take a picture, bam. It's, you know, so you can actually get a lot more data by putting it on a gimbal. But a gimbal in space is a very complex thing.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Sure. Yeah.
And so that's the knack. And then the whack is not similar to the other ones we've seen. You might not know it was a camera. So you see the black thing there. That is like the aperture. And so it has a cover on it right now, right? And this is somebody just on a flow bench again.
But it's a good picture of it, it looks like, right?
Oh, it's great. This is good. Look how clean it is.
Yeah.
They have the gloves on over their cuffs and everything. And so the kind of like the vertical thing, that's the electronics. So there's like two slices, two boards in there probably.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's got harness out to those circular connectors. So those are just like the wires that hook up to everything. And then that whole thing gets bolted on and it's wide angle. So no gimbal on this guy. But that aperture is much wider, right, than those huge cylindrical things.
It's huge, yeah.
Yeah. So that's why you have two of them, right? You can't really get that with just one camera. It's easier to just use two.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but, that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's the knack and the whack. And these are all... So the thing about Europa is it is a Class A mission, which basically means it's the lowest risk in terms of, like, you know, when you send things to space, when you put things on an explosive to launch it into space, possibly into the sun, there are always risks, like chances that things will go wrong, right?
Sure.
So you can like manage those and be like, okay, what's the risk? What risk will we accept? If you spend $1 trillion on one thing, you want that risk to be fucking 0%. If you spend, you know, a few thousand dollars to launch a grad student project off like a plane, you don't necessarily care from a certain perspective, not, you know, caring about it, but it's not as important that it is extremely reliable, right? Europa is the highest level of the lowest level of risk tolerance. So it's very expensive.
So despite my accusations of it being wildly optimistic, in fact, it is like, this is about as careful as they can be.
Yes. And
is
no.
that what you're saying? Okay.
So
okay.
There's a lot of effort put into these things. It is a very difficult mission. Yeah, you're not wrong.
My understanding of what it's doing is it's visiting everyone, right? It's going everywhere.
Well, it's flying by everything, yeah. It's like, well, right. You might as well say hi as you're shooting off to Jupiter.
But it's like, okay, so I had a great breakdown of it before, and now I can't quite find it. But it's like, it visits... Do you have it? Do you know this? And you can just save me scrambling.
No, so that's because it changes, and also it probably will depend on the launch window. It might have gone by Venus. So, you know, Jupiter's pretty far away. You have to get there. It takes a lot of thrust. Delta V, right? So there was an idea of doing different gravity assists, where you kind of slingshot a thing using gravity of planets. I don't know what they ended up doing. They were going to do a Venus flyby. I know they're not doing that anymore. I couldn't tell you.
Let's see.
But that's not necessarily the hardest part. That's, you know, just the stars literally aligning, right? I guess you have to plan your flight path too.
But. Okay, this isn't as bad as I thought. Yeah, it is a Mars Earth assist. Mega, they call it. sure. Jackasses. And then it orbits Europa 41 times. But like, yeah, the original plan, as you say, was like it would go to it would go from Earth to Venus to Mars to like three different moons and then finally to Europa. And I was like, y'all need to calm down.
They did. The thing is, Venus, if you go there, you get really hot. So it was like a whole nother thermal case you had to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, Europa. So then I think for our last the thing, the piece de resistance, which is the thing I know the most about by far, is PIMS, the PIMS instrument on Europa. It is the plasma instrument for magnetic sounding.
This is the one that, like, this is the name that I know because of you and I knew before this, right? It's like, in casual conversation, you'll be like, work, blah, 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 the PIMS. And I'm like, I see. Okay.
The PIMS. PIMS is also a liquor that almost probably nobody knows. I think it's more of a British thing. I don't remember why they named it this. And it's also kind of a ATM machine and pin number type deal. Because, you know, we always say, you know, oh, the NAC instrument, you know, the Draco instrument, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're not just going to say the PIMS. It's always the PIMS instrument.
Sure. It's
the plasma instrument for magnetic sounding instrument.
Oh, so it's an ATM machine situation. Great. Love it.
Exactly. Just listen. Yep. So let's see. I'll go over the theory first, and then it'll kind of break down to the visuals. This is a very, very interesting instrument. It's the first of this kind we've ever built at APL. So it is a Faraday cup, which, as I say, it senses plasma. That's what its job as a Faraday cup is. The idea is that you have an aperture, so it's like a little, it's literally a cup, okay? And at the bottom, you have a conductive thing that you sense current off of. Because plasma is charged particles, and when charged particles hit a conductor, that's charge that moves through a conductor. That is current. That is what is called current.
Well, okay, so ignorant time. Mm-hmm. Then you just measure how much current you've got, and that's how much plasma you've got.
Yep.
You're done.
Yep.
Oh, well, that seems really easy then.
It is. So what if you want to know more than the fact that there is plasma?
Or oh, no, but I mean,
a certain amount of plasma.
Well, what else would you want to know?
Direction and energy.
You want to know the direction that electricity is coming from.
Not electricity.
I mean, yeah.
So the solar wind, right? The solar wind is plasma, blows plasma.
Right.
And so you actually, it's a good calibration source because you know where the sun is and you know which way the plasma from the sun
speak for yourself, motherfucker.
Guys, where's the sun?
It's night. It's gone.
So yeah, so PIMS will actually use that as calibration of light. It'll be fun.
Okay.
But gotcha. So Europa, one of the things probably should have said this. The Europa mission's job is to do science on Europa, the icy moon of Jupiter, which is very interesting. It's a good spot for life to form because it has a liquid ocean, a liquid water ocean, but it's under, you know, a thick ice crust, and it might be warm. We don't know how thick the ice crust is. So that's a thing that'd be really interesting to know, would tell us a lot about everything there. Mm-hmm. And so you can do that certain ways. By magnetic field, basically, you can tell, you know, Earth has a magnetic field. Why? Because we have a core, liquid molten metal core, and it spins and stuff like that. Right.
Right.
You can learn stuff about a planet from measuring its magnetic field. The problem is that you're at fucking Jupiter, which is just like a fire hose of radiation, magnetic field, plasma, everything. Right.
It's like trying to take someone's like body temperature while they're standing in a burning building.
Yeah. Essentially
complicates things a little.
Yeah. So if you can measure the burning building, you can subtract that, and then you just have the person's body temperature. So
okay,
there is a magnetometer on Europa that senses magnetic fields, basically. But without knowing the plasma, because moving plasma is okay, you can think of it like electricity again, right? Current causes magnetic fields.
Right.
Is there a good analogy here that people will know? Well, electromagnets, magnets that can turn on and off, they do that by passing current through loops of wire, and it makes a magnetic field.
Sure.
What was I saying? Oh, so yeah. So the plasma, right? As the plasma moves, it's charge and it moves, so it creates a magnetic field. So PIMS's job, in order to make the magnetic measurement sound, to sound the magnetic measurement, measures plasma.
Oh, so you're measuring plasma to do like, so you're not subtracting temperature, you're subtracting like level of magnetism? That sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. It is really interesting. Yeah. It is really hard and interesting. So that's what, so each PIMS has two Faraday cups, and there are two copies of PIMS on the spacecraft, so that you have, you're kind of trying to point in every direction. Because PIMS doesn't just sense like the amount of plasma. In order to know, you know, the vector, the direction, right, of the magnetic field, and more properties, you want to know the direction of the plasma, you know, the direction your current, more or less, is flowing. So if you look, this is a great picture. If you look into the cup on this first picture, you'll see it has kind of like a pie chart, right? Like three slices of pie, the peace symbol. Those are, we call them triants, because I don't know, they're not quadrants. What do you call something that's three triants? You can't call them tridents. You could. So they're triants. And so you measure the current on each individually. And that already starts to give you more information than just one collector.
Because
plate, we call it,
based on the direction the plasma's coming from, it'll conduct differently?
So if you think about, let's see, go back to the Google Doc, right?
Okay, yes.
And the picture on the right says PIMS flow direction. So what we're looking at is a cross-section of a cup. And at the bottom is this, you know, three slices equal area slices of pie. And you can see that green dot on the right. So it says ABC for the different collector triants. And you see that green circle. Imagine that's the beam of plasma coming in at a certain direction.
So in this example, it's like looking at it, the circle, the based on the way it's divided up, assuming they have different sensors, which I'm sure is the whole fucking point.
Yep.
It's like, okay, it's mostly on B, it's partially on C, it's very little on A. Based on this, we know that the plasma is mostly coming from the upper right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Sure.
That's the theory of operation. The thing is, so this is the first type of this type of instrument we've built at APL. Not many people have built this, but I think Smithsonian Research Institute did the plasma, the Faraday cup for solar probe, I think. But so they use, and Voyager, I think, had one. I think Voyager had
one. That was like 50 years ago. Y'all are clowns.
Well,
this has been solved already.
No, it wasn't. I forget what it was. But they used quadrants. So we said, you know, our proposal was, hey, we can do it with three. And that makes electronics much, much nicer and stuff. So that's the basic operation of what it measures. It measures plasma at three different points. As you move, you know, a circle around on a circle with three pie slices, you get more or less current on different slices of the pie. That gives you direction.
Okay.
Now, if you want to know energy, energy will tells you, like, what is the plasma? Like, what charged gas, like, plasma type thing is this? So, if you have... let's think of it of the hill analogy. It's used a lot in electronics. So, you have a hill that you have to get up, right?
Sure.
It takes a certain amount of energy to bike up that hill. If you don't have enough energy... You fall back down the hill. You don't make it up over the hill. So if your friends are throwing a party on the other side of this hill and you can't make it up, then you don't get to the party. Well, so PIMS does that electrically. If you apply a voltage to grids in front of your cup, in front of your collector, right? You can reject plasma that doesn't have enough energy to get over the hill.
Oh, so you have a staggered layers of like increasing...
So you can barely see it here, but yeah, on the left, those are our tungsten grids. These are like film-thick tungsten grids that are, I think, 85% transparent or higher. It's just really, really tiny grids. And so we have like 12 of those. And so we have a high-voltage power supply, a bunch of grounds. We have a low-voltage one. And then there's, it's called a suppressor voltage, which is kind of like right by the collector pie slices, because when plasma like hits it, it actually will kind of bounce off electrons for reasons, and so you want to push those back down. So we have three different voltages that are applied in this cup in order to give you even more information. Yeah, so like the PIMS HVPS, so I did all, like, I worked on all of the electronics for this. It was a very small team. I know how this entire thing works. Not in a bragging way, in like a, I think it's personally very cool way. That's, you know, doing things for the first time, or like not doing the same thing over and over. It's a thing I like doing. It's hard, but, so the high voltage power supply in this, on like that front grid, basically, if it puts 5 kilovolts on that grid, right? And you can imagine, you know, it's an electric field, right? Because if you have a voltage and then you have a ground source, electric field is defined as volts per meter. So if you have a battery with 1 volt and you have ground a meter away, you have a 1 volt per meter electric field. So we apply, say, 5 kilovolts to this grid and it has a ground grid in front of it. You apply a strong electric field. If you have a plasma that's 4 kilovolts, 4 kiloelectron volts, you'd say, then it can't get up that 5 kilovolt hill, right? And so you don't see it at all on the collector. There's no current. But if you have a 6 kiloelectron volt plasma, then it gets through and then it goes back down the hill because you have electric field going one way, because you have ground to high voltage grid looking into the cup. But if you have another ground underneath that, you have the reverse electric field, so you speed it up again.
I see. So you correct for what you subtracted.
Essentially, yeah. So you don't wildly go crazy with a plasma.
What happens with a tie?
Exactly. So you actually... this figure... So the PIMS paper that this figure comes from is actually fairly early on. The answer for angles is not quite this simple. It's actually very, very hard. There'll be a thing we joke about a lot because it takes so fucking long for many of these things to get where they're going and get data back is the proverbial PhD student in a decade will figure things out like that. But the plasma actually bends like as an S curve and it depends on your angle. It actually depends on cosine squared. How much the energy seems like it falls off.
Oh, great. All right.
Yes. Anyways,
I've lost interest.
You've been asking all the right questions and have figured things out very impressively. But yeah, so it's not people who get paid some bucks, PhDs, will figure out. I mean, we know the theory and we have proven, like, calibrated it, right? But in order to extract, like, the best possible science and figure out what all the data means, that will be papers. Those will be white papers.
Gotcha.
So that's PIMS. And oh, the high voltage power supply part of this is the coolest part. It goes from minus 2000 to plus 7000 volts. And it's, I don't know this. It is a arbitrary waveform generator in that it can make over time any like waveform in between there, right? It could do a sine wave from 0 to 7000 volts. It could do a square wave. It could, you know, do a triangle. It could do a squiggly. It'll do whatever you want, which is really cool.
These are just fun things. They're not particularly useful for your mission.
No, so it actually is. That's the thing. So,
really?
Oh, that's so. I've explained how it can get all this information, right? Europa is doing these pedals, right? It's clipping, so you're not going to sit in the same spot for a long time.
One of the things that keeps, like, I think I get it every time, but I can imagine someone who wouldn't. The fact that you're talking about the planet Europa and their Europa Clipper shortened to Europa. Which,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. The Europa Clipper mission. So, you know, it's like the camera, right? The NAC has a gimbal because you're flying by, right? You're not just going to, like, sit and image the same thing for forever. PIMS isn't just going to sit, you know, in the same Jovian environment forever. It's going to fly by. And it's actually, we get very close to Europa, close enough to, we want to measure plumes of like stuff that might plume off the surface. So
it's pretty close.
Yeah. You also want good time resolution. So you have to like get all this measurement, all the measurements and stuff you want to sense, you want to sense it pretty quickly so you can move on to sensing the next type of information, right?
Sure, sure.
So the reason that we have this sweeping, we call it HVPS, or switching HVPS, is so that you can get information of like, okay, what plasma is there from minus 2,000 to plus 7,000 kiloelectron volts, right? Because if your hill is 5,000 volts, everything above 5,000 volts gets through. But if you go, if you go down to 1 keV, then it's like, oh, okay, well, now we've only rejected, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so
but
as
it's a series of hills.
It's a series of hills, but the faster you can do it, the better. And so it actually does step very fast, stepping operation. So within 10 milliseconds, we step from 0 to 7,000 volts, and then we kind of do this square wavy thing where we sit at certain voltages for a little bit of time and then go down to the next level, down to the next level, down to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Until you've covered the energy range you want to measure. So, you know, 7 to minus 2,000, we just, you know, keep stepping down. But it also applies an AC. So it does these DC steps down, and that, like, it's the regular flat level. So it's a flat line for each step, right? It's stair step.
Right. Right.
But there's also a little wiggle during each stair step, because you can get a lot more information if you just sense a little bit of wiggle in current than if you just sense these big floods of plasma, right? You're just...
Sure.
If you're, are you sensing the burning building, or are you sensing the wiggle?
I think I understand. It is, your phrasing is very funny, and I'm having to think pretty hard because I've never thought about any of this before.
I don't know. I whiteboard this out all the time. Like, I can explain it well that way. The entire concept, I don't know if I've ever explained the entire concept. I really like talking about PIMS because I think I'm probably the person who understands this the most, which is very strange. not the science, to be clear, not the science. How the instrument actually works, though. You can't see electronics inside here, but they're very cool and very unique things to work on.
There was a time where we had to delay a podcast because you were like, I have to go into work and make the PIMS work better under low temperatures, under near absolute zero temperatures.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, not because, near absolute. It's at probably 90 Kelvin, you know.
Right, but yeah, so basically it's like when it gets really cold, the conductivity goes to shit, and I need to go into work and fix this. Our stupid talk about Taco Bell will have to wait.
It was a thing during TVEC, yeah. I don't know if I should say the specifics of that, so I won't, but for better or for worse, I can manually run things, or like, you know, Jesus can take the wheel in terms of like, okay, let me actually go down to the super low level, which I really like. It's like really interesting, and I feel, you know, accomplished. Like, I've worked on this thing for 6 years, even when I was still in school. So, you know, it's sad to see it go, kind of, in certain ways not. But yeah, so explaining the whole thing is overwhelming. I need a whiteboard. But yeah, the high voltage power supplies got me into doing high voltage stuff. And now I do high voltage stuff all the time at work. It's very enjoyable. Most of us on the team got, you know, a little bit of a shock from the HVPS. which, to be clear, has no energy. So that's the thing. It goes up to 7,000 volts. It doesn't have any energy, though, right? Like, it's not a very high power.
Right.
So it doesn't actually hurt you. It doesn't cause harm. It feels very strange. I've only done it a few times, but yeah. Huh. So, what does PIMS look like, Six?
It looks like a weird camera.
It kind of does. So it has two cups, right? So these are very wide cups, like almost plate-sized cups that are, I'd say, like 4 inches deep. It kind of narrows as it goes down. Until, you know, the collector at the bottom, the little gold thing. So it's all silver. The outside, you see it's painted black. There's a very special paint for thermal reasons. And you can see, so we have a picture of both PIMS flight models on the bench here. On the left is the one that's coated in Mylar. So that's blanketed up. I'll blanket it up like it'll be in space, kind of. And the right one is unblanketed. So you can see, you know, we've got our APL logos we plaster everywhere, hopefully, to be seen. And it's this cube with two cups on it. The inside the cube is what looks cooler.
Curiosity, what's inside the cube? All right.
Eventually, yes. I need to write it. I need to, like, so that's the thing. You're like, oh, can you talk about this? And it's like, oh, actually, we talk about it all the time because it's like we're, you know, an educational research institution. Like, we should write papers on stuff. So I need to write a paper on the HVPS and the stuff. On the inside, it's a bit of a rat's nest because there are... so each triant, right, gets its own wire because they have to have a wire from there to the electronics. So that's three on one cup, three on the other. You have six. And then I said that there's an HV, LV, and suppressor grid on each. So that's three more. And you need a ground. So there's a lot of stuff. This is not a very big cube either.
I like that the triant, like looking at the triant from the top, it looks like a nonstick baking sheet. Like the little, like the silicone things you put over top of a baking sheet.
It kind of does. It's so bad. Yeah. Yeah, these are some fun things. They're very, very... They're less fragile than you would think. It's very strange, this tungsten stuff. And then the last picture, you can see it's a different angle here. We have the red tag covers on, so it's just covers on top of the cups before you deploy the plasma cannons. And that's my coworker Eric pretending to inspect things with a UV light.
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. Yeah.
I guess the fun thing about PIMS, so we have, you know, a calibration chamber, right? So it's a vacuum chamber, because in order to shoot plasma, you kind of need a vacuum to have charged gas spewing into things. Otherwise, it's not going to work very well for you. And so then we have a plasma gun, because you need to shoot plasma at it. So we have a plasma beam.
Gun. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, so we have a pencil beam. So there's two. We have a pencil beam, which is a very narrow, like little thin laser type-ish beam, right?
And the other one's a toothpaste beam, right?
Exactly. This is for pointing, right? To know the direction. You want to have a very tiny, well, actually not. Anyways, we have a very tiny plasma beam. And then we also have an electron gun. That's like what you actually usually call them. It's an electron gun, so that you can shoot positive and negative charged particles into the cup. So those are small, right? But in space, we're going to get like this, you know, the PIMS flow direction chart shows a big cup filling beam, right? There's going to be the plasma, the whole burning room. So in order to simulate that and calibrate that, you need a really big source. So we did eventually buy a 12-inch wide, I think, plasma source that is the plasma cannon. Because it's just like a big ass like spew. It is huge for a thing. Yep. So we have a plasma cannon that was fun to calibrate with.
Wow.
Yeah. The inside of this is the cooler thing. The HVPS. I need to put a picture of the HVPS on to show you eventually.
Yeah, I mean, if you can get one before this goes live Wednesday, then you know,
unlikely. Yeah.
But otherwise. Yeah. Yeah, I've always thought space and, you know, space tech is really cool, and it is really weird to have someone in my life who just knows it. it's cool. I did not expect to be able to understand the PIMS, so thank you for your good explanation.
Look at you being grammatically correct. Not the PIMS instrument.
I can't do it. But
you know what I can't say that. So we usually put silly silk screen things on. Not silly. So silk on boards, right? You have like PCBs, circuit boards. You have like labels, right?
Right.
You can put little pieces of, you know, ink on for labeling things. You can just put whatever you want on there. And so I drew a PIMS bottle, like a bottle of the PIMS liquor that may or may not, I can neither confirm nor deny, be on some of the PIMS circuit boards as well as some other things.
So we're crowing a bottle out to Europa.
Exact.
At some point in the future.
Yeah. No, I'm going to put Kisa B on the next one.
You're worse.
That would be something. I think
we've
done it.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Nicholas.
Thanks for having me. Did we win?
Sure. You know, I think this has been the most technical episode we've ever had. That's certainly, you know.
Wow.
You'll be surprised to learn that they often don't explain how Gundams work.
I'm not surprised to learn. So I have watched... what did I watch? I know I watched all of Zeta with you, right?
You watched all of Zeta. You
Double?
Watched some... No, you watched some Iron-Blooded Orphans.
Right. I thought I watched some Double O.
I don't think you watched any Double O, but okay, maybe I'm just not aware of this. Probably not. Did watch... Hathaway's
Flash part one.
Yeah
Okay. No, I've watched Double Zeta a little bit.
Oh no, it's Double O is a different show. Double Zeta is a show. Double O is another show. Yeah, you watched,
but I watched
Double Zeta
too,
for sure,
right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
Double Zeta. But like, so that's my whole thing. I'm sorry, Gundam, this is the wrong audience. Gundam audience, just, if it's so good to have more Gundams, right? Like, having the Gundam, it's called Gundam because the Gundams are so important to accomplishing the goals of the organization. almost all the time, right? But nobody's talking about, like, controlling the means of production. Like, S6, like, who the fuck makes the Gundam? Why don't you just have them make more Gundams?
Like, why isn't the whole show about Anaheim research? Gundam Seed.
And I heard that, but like, why? That should be the whole point. Like, oh, the mission. Oh, we got to do this. Just go get more Gundams. Go put resources into making Anaheim able to make more Gundams and like buy.
Nick, what the hell's wrong with you? Why aren't there more PIMs?
Because they haven't paid us. Pay me to. I will build. Well, maybe not. I'll build more PIMs. I'm going to do it on my own. But just like. Listen, you know, the TSMC, Samsung, you buy time at the chip fab. Like, okay, I buy this, you know, allotment of time. Just get all your resources and just buy Gundam time.
It's Gundam time.
This is...
You have unintentionally stumbled upon numerous things.
This is Gundam. What if I had a Gundam Jeopardy?
What if you told people where they could find you on the internet? Because I would like to have dinner before I go to work.
What if you dinner? Like, I'm going to eat your dinner. You should probably just... Maybe you probably shouldn't. You can find Six and I on Bottle Crow Reborn, a formerly Dota 2 turned Chaos Variety Show, where we never talk about Dota 2. Usually don't talk about space. Couldn't tell you what we talk about. It's a lot less hinged than this episode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At Bottlecrow on Twitter. I guess I'm at _UraniumHeart on Twitter.
Now, for all the uranium you keep trying to make them use in space.
It's actually plutonium.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry, doctor. As for me, you can find me on Twitter at @6Detmar. You can DM me there if you have DMs are open.
Did you just forget?
What?
Maybe. You paused for... Okay. You paused for... You can find me at... Wait.
You already did that.
Where can you?
You already did the @UraniumHeart.
No, you paused as if you forgot your Twitter handle.
No, I paused because you were playing a fucking sound and I wanted to wait for it to finish.
No, it was over at that point.
Anyway, at 6Detmar on Twitter, DMs are open. Any questions or comments for Scanline Media? Hey, we don't ask this very often. In fact, we basically ask this never, and I need to get in the habit. You should review us on like podcasting services. It genuinely does more than you think. It is very helpful.
We probably should. Also, we need to fucking update the podcast description of Bottle Crow already.
Sure. Well, listen, if they do their job, we'll do ours. You can find the rest of my work at scanlinemedia.com or patreon.com/scanlinemedia. As mentioned, the Nick and I dynamic, much less serious, can be found
in
Bottle Crow.
Motivated people on the internet can accomplish almost anything.
And until next time, folks. Nick, the way we usually end the episode is by having a quote from like the sort of like related to the project, right? Often it's like a quote from the show or whatever. You can literally say anything and it'll be a quote from you, the person who built PIMS. So just say whatever you want.
Well, it's from our director, but this is, you know, this is something I just came up with. Be bold, do great things, and make the world a better place.
Yeah, that wouldn't be something you came up with at all. Peace. Thank you.